Good evening. My name's Garland Nixon, and this is News Views, and I'm here with my esteemed panelist.
Mark Levine.
Your mic on there, Mark Levine. This is News Views on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., the Pacific affiliate. We've got lots to talk about. There is certainly a lot in the news. We had the State of the Union Tuesday night, and we had what's been known as Watergate, a very humorous incident that happened that I think it's something we can talk about if we get to that.
With Marco Rubio.
He had a very unique experience with a bottle of water.
He had a lunge.
Yeah. That was one that won't soon be forgotten. But what I want to start with is a guy named Chris Dorner. And I'm going to open up the phones early, too. You certainly want to get some calls today. But Chris Dorner, he was a law enforcement officer out in L.A. who at some point in one way or another ran afoul of the LAPD's policies. What happened, who was right and wrong, we don't know. We know what the results of the incident was. We do know that he was at some point charged with filing a false report. We do know that at some point he received some type of administrative hearing and he was represented by a captain, and that at some point he lost and was fired and pretty much freaked out and went on a killing spree. And, of course, we all know the end. He was found burned in a cabin and appears, I guess, he shot himself. Mark.
He was a veteran of the Iraq War, and he was a Los Angeles Police Department officer. Mm-hmm. And according to his complaint, he and a co-officer were I guess arresting someone who's mentally ill or taking, and he was actually getting a fight with this mentally ill person. Mm-hmm. And his co-officer apparently tased the mentally ill person, and in his complaint said that she kicked the mentally ill person after tasing him. Mm-hmm. She denies it. It's his word, her word. Mm-hmm. I guess we could never really know what happened. But he filed the complaint and he lost the complaint, mm-hmm. and then they fired him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he charged the department with racism and discharged the military. He filed a lawsuit and lost all the way up in the California Court of Appeals. Then he decided to get vengeance in his own way, and he shot and killed the daughter and fiance, the daughter of the man who was defending him, mm-hmm. in the military procedure. He killed that man's daughter and her fiance,
right?
Which, I mean, obviously the two of them were innocent of anything. Not that anyone deserves to die for. And then, of course, went on the manhunt, and that's the part that most of us saw leading up to the. To the State of the Union address.
Yeah, and here's why it's of particular interest to me. For those of you who haven't maybe been listening to News Views and don't know, I was a law enforcement officer for many years. I retired as a high-ranking officer, holding the rank of major. So I went from the bottom to the top. I participated in charging officers. And in fact, let me say this. In 1992, I was charged with filing a false report. I went to the state of Maryland. I filed a. But generally, if a person believes when they make a statement that somebody did something wrong, if I say Mark did this, and at the time I believe he did it, I could be 100% wrong. The information I got could have been all wrong. But if I believe that Mark kicked that innocent person, and I say, hey, you know what? I want to file a complaint that Mark kicked that innocent person. No one can take any personnel action. The whistleblower is
why, you know, after O.J. Simpson, after Rodney King, that the community was very upset because Los Angeles Police Department has this reputation. Maybe they've fixed it. I don't know. I don't live in L.A. now. Right. I don't know whether they have or they haven't. But this guy started through the proper channels, and he lost. Mm-hmm. Now, again, I don't know the merits of his case. I have not read his complaint, and I don't say that judges always get it right either. I'm a lawyer.
Right.
So I
right.
know that judges sometimes get it wrong. But sometimes, even when injustice is done, mm-hmm. Then you do things like you take it to the streets. You can take it to your politician. Antonio Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles, is a good liberal, solid. I mean, he's all I've heard is good things about this mayor. He could have gone to the mayor. He could have gone to city council. He could have gone to state legislators. He could have gone to the governor, all of whom are Democrats and good people. Could have written to the president of the United States, to Barack Obama. Could have written to Eric Holder, the attorney general, Justice Department, said, I want to investigate Los Angeles Police Department's racism. He had all these political outlets to go to. And instead, he took a gun and started shooting innocent people.
Right.
And to me, this just sort of shows, for one thing, the gun debate. It shows the dangers of these kinds of weapons in the hands of people. But it also shows, I think, that no matter how angry he was, I mean, I think it's fair to say, Garland, that had you lost your legitimate complaint, you would have been very, very upset, but you would have taken the AR-15 and started shooting people.
The next thing I would have done, I mean, under my circumstances, I couldn't possibly see myself losing, but let's just say for the purpose of argument,
it can happen. There's bad judges.
The next thing I would have done would be I would have went to the press and said, hey, look, I would have went
to... There's always the press.
Yeah, I would have went to a lot of journalists and say, hey, look, I've got this story.
There you go.
You know, let's get it out in the media. And I would have kept searching until I found a journalist somewhere that said, I'll put this in my magazine or
That's
on
right.
my newspaper, even if it was the little, you know, Crab Wrapper Gazette in Crisfield, Maryland.
Right. So,
I would have went somewhere to address it. I certainly was not planning on pulling out. And let me say one other thing, Mark. I've seen both sides of the fence. I've seen where myself and other officers had filed complaints and then that ended in a lawsuit and racism and won. But I also saw the other end, where I know of a particular instance where I was involved, where an officer was dead wrong. You couldn't be any more wrong than he was, African-American officer, and he filed a complaint of racism. And not only was it not racism, he was wrong. He's the one, if anything, the civilian should have sued him for violating their constitutional rights. But at any rate...
This guy just sort of had a difficulty with truth, or I mean, I don't want to... You're not going to give names, of course.
He had issues.
What were his issues? Mentally?
He had some mental issues. It was obvious there was something going on.
He was
the guy that you could have saw doing something like this, and he ended up getting fired.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up ultimately getting fired.
He could have been a Chris Dorner.
Right, yeah. But I say that to say I was in an instance, and I saw other officers in instances where they were right, and they filed lawsuits for racism, and they were wrong. But then I saw another instance here where this guy was as wrong as you could be. He filed a racism lawsuit. Well, he tried to file a racism lawsuit. It got thrown out before it was even, you know, got dismissed with prejudice before it even went to court because there was nothing there. So we don't know the story on Mr. We don't know, but we do know
that if you have a complaint, so we can complain.
Well, let me get out the number. Let me get
out
the number real quick. We want to get out the number early because I'm sure people have something to say about that. 202-588-0893. 202-588-0893. We're talking about Chris Dorner. Whatever you want to talk about, if it's Chris Dorner, if it's the law, police in general, law enforcement, black cops, white cops, whatever you want to talk about.
Or the State of the Union, if you want, or Marco Rubio.
Well, we'll do the second half.
We'll do that second half.
We'll after 6:30. But anything you might want to talk about relative to this, because in the black community, whenever you bring up the issue of law enforcement, there is a long record of mistreatment and abuse.
Absolutely.
And certainly that...
And certainly that's true of the Los Angeles Police Department.
Yeah. So, you know, that's certainly going to always strike a nerve. So 202-588-0893. We certainly want to hear from you. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., the Pacific affiliate.
I have no idea, but once he did what he did, it sure doesn't help the cause of trying to fight racism and corruption in the Los Angeles Police Department to go on a killing spree. That's just not going to help the cause.
Well, fortunately, we have with us Dr. Alan Lichtman, who was a guest a few weeks back. He was a terrific guest.
I have to say.
And he is a civil rights expert.
Okay.
I might add.
I want to hear from
you. You there, Dr. Lichtman?
I am here, Garland.
Well, we'll call you Alan for the rest of the show. We're talking about Chris Dorner, the LAPD officer, and what happened there. And that second half of the show, we want to get into the State of the Union. But one of the things that we brought out...
I'll probably be on until 6:30, so if you want to get to the State of the Union pretty quickly, we probably should.
Oh, okay. So you can only get us till 6:30?
I'll give you till 6:45 at the latest.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question about this. I know you have a a background in the issue of civil rights, and that certainly with the LAPD, one of the things that happens in the African American community, that anytime law enforcement, the word police, law enforcement, et cetera, comes up, the issue of civil rights rises to the top,
sure.
And the African American community is generally takes the position that they're wrong because of the history. Do you have any thoughts on this issue, on the Chris Dorner issue, or what happened, or the circumstances surrounding it?
Well, everything about it is unfortunate, of course. It is tragic that lives should have been lost regardless of the motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the way to deal with civil rights is not to take the law into your own hands, not to kill innocent people who really had nothing to do with the complaint that he believes he had against the LAPD, whether valid or not.
Mm-hmm.
This is certainly not the way to go about it.
Absolutely.
And the complaint may well be valid, and even the LAPD said that they're going to
look they're
going to
reopen
it. But the problem is, of course, the grisly crime far overshadows the complaint, even if it was valid.
Right. And the thing about it is, issues like that, apparently one of the things that isn't discussed is Mr. Dorner was, a veteran of the Iraq War.
That's right.
He had had some issues, as I understand, there, and certainly coming back.
He probably had post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
I mean, I would think, that affects a lot of people who serve in the military, particularly in the grisly wars that are in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he probably had some mental issues that needed treated that weren't treated.
Yeah, so
that's a very good point. There's a lot of fallout here. Perhaps he was indeed mistreated by the LAPD, and indeed these horrific wars have had a terrible effect on the home front. Americans coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder, with terrible maiming injuries, many Afghans and Iraqis dying, and then, of course, the further deaths resulting from it. It's just a tragic situation all around.
Yeah, and if you remember, if we go back to during the Vietnam War, that was an issue. A number of veterans coming
sure.
back from the Vietnam War that were going to prison for killing people. They go into a bar and they get in a fight and they react with violence. And that was an issue all throughout the Vietnam War and through the 70s, where huge numbers of Vietnam veterans were in jail for violent crimes, extremely violent crimes. And certainly that's an issue. We're going to touch on this a little bit more. We've got some callers on, and then we are going to get to the State of the Union address. That's important. But we want to take a couple callers. We have John. John, welcome to WPFW. Is John there?
Hi, John.
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, John, what do you have to say? Thank you for calling.
No problem. I actually wanted to talk about Christopher Dorner.
Mm-hmm.
I was just listening to your commentaries, and I think it's a bit absurd that you would make statements such as he could call the mayor or call Eric Holder or the president. I mean, let's be realistic. Is the president and Eric Holder really going to be returning calls and letters from a petty officer in Los Angeles that's fired due to racism, which is one of the common accusations that come out from a lot of officers when they do leave duty? It's just that really doesn't make sense. So, it's not to justify what he's done, but let's just be realistic. Sometimes officers, or just African Americans in general, are put in a position where they can't defend themselves because the system's already set up in a way that they feel just unable to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
Am I live on the air?
Yes, you are. You are live on the air. Well, we got a little delay going on, but you are live on the air. And
okay.
you make a great point, and I think the point that Mark was making was not necessarily what the individual steps that he could take, but the point overall point he was making is there are a lot of alternative paths that you can choose and avenues you can go down to address.
Yeah, but those are not realistic issues. Alternatives. I mean,
here's the thing.
Fair. You live in Washington, D.C. area. Mm-hmm. I do myself as well. The chances of you even getting a letter back from your mayor is very small. Let me tell you something. It's a quick example. Hyattsville Police Department. I had a situation where the police responded when I was getting assaulted almost 10 to 15 minutes later. I wrote the letter to the police commander. I wrote a letter to the mayor of Hyattsville. I didn't hear from either one of them.
Yeah.
If anything, I heard from one of their junior officers that responded in the situation because I had already filed a complaint. So, thinking of someone at a high stature like Eric Holder or the president or even the mayor of Los Angeles, There's no way these people are going to respond to this guy.
Well, you know, I don't.
Let me just say, thank you very much for your call. And just the point is that even now you're on the phone. You're not, you know, you weren't in a, you didn't get burned up in a cabin somewhere because you killed a bunch. You know what I mean?
Well, that's
true. Here's,
but also,
caller,
look, and I don't know anything about the mayor police of Hyattsville, and they may be terrible. I used to work for a member of Congress, though, and we responded to every single letter that was written to us, and he was very clear about that. Now, not that all are that responsible, but if there's a systemic problem, in other words, if Eric Holder gets one letter from one L.A. police officer claiming racism, you're right, he's probably not going to do anything. If he got 10 letters, then someone underneath him would probably think that's worthy enough of a response. If he got 100 letters, then I think, yeah, Attorney General Eric Holder would probably be notified, because he has taken action to try to prevent racist voting things, I know, down in the South. So part of it, yeah, you're right, one person alone can't do anything, but you combine 100 people together, and you can. And I think that, of course, there always is the press. There's always Pacifica. There's always stations out there where even if someone isn't listening and you write, and this is broader, obviously, than Christopher Dorner, but if you're mistreated and you do go through the proper sources, you go to the police, you go to the courts, you go to your mayor or city councilman, and no one listens to you, then that's exactly what the press is all about. And at the end of the day, you may have to do marches.
Yeah.
You know?
Alan, that brings to mind a good question, and that
is, and have them try to pursue your case. There's a pretty strong branch of the ACLU, for example, out in California. There's a branch of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law. Those would be the appropriate places to go. And
there's
they
the ACLU.
Do have the resources. They do have the clout. They do have the know-how. If the complaint is valid, and you know, to pursue it. And that's what I would suggest any of your listeners to do if they feel they...
Once I went to the Black Officers Association and said, why doesn't the Black Officers Association join? Everyone's had severe problems. There's a terrible record with this police department. If we all go join together...
And that's just
then,
one complaint, 100 complaints.
Then
that's
they
the difference
can't
right
retaliate
there.
Against an innocent person. So I think that's a good point there when you say, Alan, that...
We agree with that. The more you can muster, the better. There's always strength in numbers, and there's always strength in organizations. I think that's an excellent combination.
Yes. And we have Stephanie. Stephanie, welcome to WPFW. Thank you for calling.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to say that it's in no way, this is also about the Christopher Dorner thing, in no way to excuse anything that he did, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I absolutely believe that. that what he was saying, you know, in his manifesto and what he said about corruption in the police department and racism in the police department, I believe he was probably telling the truth. I myself am white, and I've seen it myself. As a resident of the District of Columbia some years ago, there was an African-American gentleman, and I lived in an English basement apartment, and he was sleeping in front of my door, and he was clearly lost. He was clearly disoriented. 24 hours later, he was still there, and we were worried, my roommate and I, that he was going to die because we knew he had nothing but like a half a glass of milk in 24 hours. So I called the police. And when I called them, I said, I want you to be very clear. We are not complaining about him being here. He's not doing anything bad, but we are worried that he's going to die. These young, strapping white guys came and picked up this little 90-pound, disoriented, elderly man and started shoving him. And I got in their face, and I said, I'm not going anywhere until you call an ambulance. And I had to do that because they were standing up this man who could... totally disoriented, barely stand, and shoving him and saying, get out of here. And that is not why we called them at all. So I do, you know, I think it's very nice that you guys have so much faith in the system. It's lovely, but as someone who has appealed to, you know, now I live in Maryland, and I've gone to government agencies over provable things, and I've had assistant attorney generals lie right in my face, make up fictions right in my face. They don't care to do their job. I don't believe in any of it anymore.
Well, I don't want to say I have complete faith in the system. I certainly know about the Los Angeles Police Department. One of the things I wanted to ask you, Garland, was about the thin blue line.
Mm-hmm.
How often it is that cops protect other cops who do bad things, because that seems to be the impression that I have, and I think most people have, that police officers protect each other when they do bad things. So having been a police officer, I'd be curious to know your experience.
That's certainly an issue, and the blue line issue is certainly there. And I think what we were talking about before, that's why it's important, because the issue of, you know, where this Christopher Dorner thing opened a festering wound.
Sure.
That won't be going away for a long time. But that's why it is important when there are issues to try to get, whether it's a community who has issues with a police department or certain police officers or whatever it is, that they get as many people as they can. If it's inside a police department and they're having problems, that they get as many people as they can, because you have to get as many people as you can to actually to fight the system, because the system's going to protect itself, always protect itself.
And can it's I add something here?
Yes.
You know, in response to your last caller, one of the things we were talking about was not just going within the government, but rather contacting organizations mm-hmm. like the ACLU and the Lawyers Committee, that their mission is dedicated to civil rights. Their mission is dedicated to, in fact, challenging governments and protecting the rights mm-hmm. of individuals. Doesn't mean in every single case it's going to work, but these are organizations whose mission is consistent with protecting the rights of minorities.
And I used to be on the ACLU review committee in Maryland, and basically what we would do, people constantly come to the ACLU and they say, I've got an issue. It's a discrimination issue. It's a whatever, mistreatment from the government, government intrusion, et cetera. So people constantly come to the ACLU, and let me just say this, a great organization, a tremendous organization. And they have the complaints. And what the review committee had to do was look at these complaints and look at the various things and decide, you know, the ACLU only has but so many resources. Same with the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights. Their resources are limited. They can't take every...
Correct.
So what they have to find is either cases that are very broad-reaching in law, where there are a lot of people. So when you go to the ACLU or you go to wherever, the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights, the NAACP, even if you've got a good case, if there's one person... And, you know, they can't take every single good case. You really have to make it broad or get as many people as you can in order to demonstrate to them that they should expend their very limited resources on your particular case.
Good advice, Carl.
We've got another caller. It looks like we've got time for about one more caller before we go. And then we will talk about the State of the Union, L.
Hey. How you doing, fellas?
Wonderful. Hey, thank you for calling.
I'm good. Just quickly, I want to say that, you know, as a young, you know, 30-year-old African-American male, I've experienced extreme, you know, abuse of police power
mm-hmm.
and no recourse to Office of Police Complaints, you know, just the game, no justice there. The judges typically believe whatever the officers say, even mm-hmm. if they make it up off of the top of their heads, which I've experienced, and just no accountability. What I want to say is that, you know, there's a situation where a young girl in D.C., you know, she got kicked in the teeth and her jaw broken by an officer. And, you know, they gave her 6-month probation and he just got a reprimand and kept going. So that's the trend. And I would like to say that, you know, the police has departments all over America have a history of abusing African-American and minority families, period, for murder, the church bomb. You know, we know what's the deal. When that's done, and the police abuse people is usually perceived as, you know, justifiable. But when a man decides he wants to respect himself as a man and not allow it, then we say, oh, it's heinous. It shouldn't have been done. But there are many innocent people who have been murdered by police and never brought to justice. Police mm-hmm. are not the British. Now it's a problem. And I think that we have to keep equal violence standards. We can't condone and let cops get off for murdering innocent children. We can't. So we can't look at Dorner and say it's so heinous and out of line, because, you know, the same thing has to be held. I think it should be in balance with the police. I think that naturally if you're getting abused all the time and there's no recourse civilly, then people act like animals. That's a natural thing. And I think that I hope the justice departments and police departments around the nation really begin to take seriously the abuse that they're doing to people within their own circle.
Well, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. And then, I'll say, you know, you had a lot of good points, and I agree with a lot of what you said. But the last part, I probably disagree with you, and that is that the fact of the matter is you can't come up with a reason where it's okay to react in any circumstance with violence.
I remember, Chris Dorner didn't just, not that that's justified, but didn't just shoot at the cops that were trying to arrest him. He also shot at this woman and her boyfriend who have absolutely nothing to do with anything that happened in his life. Yeah. The fact that her father, whether he defended him well or not, I mean, so Chris Dorner flipped out. I mean, he didn't handle this right. But the issue of police violence and complaints, I mean, it's something that absolutely, whether it's protests or press or marches, has to be addressed and should be addressed.
We're going to take a quick break, and then Dr. Alan Lichtman here, is our expert on politics and presidential history, is going to tell us, he's going to interpret the State of the Union and tell us all of the issues surrounding it that we need to understand. We'll be right back in 1 second. Okay, we are back. This is News Views. My name's Garland Nix. I'm here with
Mark Levine.
And I'm on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. We have Dr. Alan Lichtman, our resident presidential historian and political genius, and he's going to talk to us. Let's talk about the State of the Union, what you thought of it historically, as you know, as opposed to other State of the Union addresses and overall.
Well, I have three words for the history of State of the Union addresses, and that is boring, boring, boring.
That's what I was going to say.
That's right. These speeches tend to be laundry lists of proposals. They're not great singing recitations like inaugural addresses often are. We have many memorable lines from inaugural addresses, like John F. Kennedy saying, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. You don't have those kinds of ringing phrases and great sentiments generally out of State of the Union addresses. And I thought Obama's speech was certainly a strong one and certainly one of the better State of the Unions. But as a speech, obviously, it was not especially memorable, although it did reach quite a crescendo in the section on guns.
That's what I was going to say. Quite emotional and quite
powerful. And if he could channel that sentiment to that and other issues, that would be very important. So therefore, what we got to study is the policy proposals. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a pretty progressive speech. He gave a progressive inaugural address, and I thought he gave a pretty progressive State of the Union address. There was no single proposal that stood out the way Obamacare, you know, stood out during his first term, something huge that had eluded presidents for many decades. But taken together, it was quite a progressive vision for the country. He did promise to do something about catastrophic climate change, though I want to return to that in a moment. Mm-hmm. Universal preschool was a terrific idea. Investing in infrastructure is something we badly need to do. Obviously, we need better gun controls. We need immigration reform. If you put it all together, it's a pretty good vision for America. On climate change, I was impressed by his idea of developing alternative sources of energy, developing a fund for getting rid of the gasoline engine. But I was disappointed that he also talked about more permits for extractive industries and the Lieberman-McCain market-based solution, which is cap and trade, which is unenforceable, doesn't work, hasn't worked in Europe. We need something stronger than that, such as a fee on polluters with a dividend to be distributed to ordinary folk, and that way you would put together climate change and the economy. I did want to get that out, but you know, he certainly put out a pretty bold and ambitious agenda. And now he's got to get the public behind it to get it through the very recalcitrant Republican House. You know, Congress is like Wall Street. It operates on two principles, fear and greed. Obviously, Obama can't give them anything to be greedy for, but he can make them fearful if he can get strong public sentiment behind his ideas, the way he has already, for example, on the gun issue.
The only thing you didn't mention, Dr. Lichtman, was he also mentioned increasing the minimum wage and indexing
it
for inflation. And I hadn't heard him say that in any prior State of the Union speeches.
No, he hadn't.
$9, he gave a specific number, $9 an hour, and he also said indexing it for inflation. He said this is the one thing
Mitt Romney
and I agreed on. I didn't remember Mitt Romney saying that, but I'll take the president's word for it. I'll take the president's word for it.
Increase in the minimum, you know, it's ridiculous how low the minimum wage is in America today. It's way behind where it was, you know, at its peak when adjusting for inflation. You're right. I didn't get to every one of them, and the minimum wage is well worth mentioning.
And the fact of the matter is, since it's not adjusted for inflation, it goes down every year.
Of course.
That's the really bad part.
Right.
Now, something I wanted to ask you about, and that is, LBJ had a, Lyndon Baines Johnson had a history of you know, getting people to do, influencing people in,
yes, by hook or by crook or by violence,
in creative ways, whether it was, you know,
bringing them into the bathroom,
things of that nature.
There until they agreed with him, you got that right.
Yeah, Obama is not going to do any of those tactics.
Here's what I want to throw out to you, and that is, you know, you did mention that one of the things you have to do is, you know, of course, the greed and fear. Historically, there have been presidents who have found creative ways to bully, push around, influence Congress, and I'm sure you could give us a few examples of some of the creative ways they've used.
Correct.
What do you think President Obama can do with this bully pulpit to accomplish some of that? And if you could give us a few examples in the past of what has been done.
Well, let's remember, of course, that Lyndon Johnson was working with an overwhelmingly Democratic Congress.
Yeah, that's true.
He didn't have to deal with a divided government the way Barack Obama had. Franklin Roosevelt, the other great Democratic reformer throughout his tenure, had very strong Democratic majorities.
True. They both had conservative Democrats.
Democratic reformer have to deal with divided government. You know, the greatest example, I think, of someone who dealt effectively with divided government, well, Garland, you might not like what he did, but in terms of the tactic and strategy, was Ronald Reagan.
Sure. Yeah.
Ronald Reagan was the man, you know, he had to deal with divided government. Now, he did have a lot of Southern conservative Southern Democrats, but it wasn't easy for him to deal with the Democratic House and Tip O'Neill. And what he did was shoot right over the heads of the Congress and use his ability as the great communicator to make sure that he had strong public support. And so, I hate to say this, but, you know, that support was shown up after the aborted assassination attempt on him when he nearly died. That greatly added. But he was able to get a consensus. And the other thing he did that nobody knows about, but it's in my book, White Protestant Nation, is he called everybody personally.
Hmm.
He made dozens and scores upon scores of personal calls to swing votes in the Congress. They identified the swing votes, and they had the president personally call those folks. And I don't care whether you're Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal, you're going to take a call from the president of the United States.
Sure. I actually think Bill Clinton did a decent job. I mean, he had a Republican Congress that was absolutely loaded for bear. They shut down the government. Newt Gingrich was out to stop him. And he won in the court of public opinion. The public opinion was that the Republicans were wrong, that Newt Gingrich was wrong. And Clinton also, I think, went over the heads of Congress to the American people. And I would argue that Barack Obama is just starting to learn that. And that's one of the things that Republicans are complaining most about. He is going and he's doing public tours, not in his second term, far more than he did in his first term, going to various places around the country, selling his proposals. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard Eric Cantor or John Boehner complain that the president is talking to the public and he's not talking to them. But the answer is talking to them doesn't get him anywhere. Yeah. Talking to the public actually does get him somewhere. So I actually see Obama slowly starting to act in that Clinton or Reaganite mold. I don't know if you agree.
One of the things that I thought resonated with me that Obama said during the campaign was that he didn't use the bully pulpit enough.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't use his powers of persuasion and communication enough during his first term. And certainly, so far, very early on in the second term, we have seen a different Obama who does seem to be following the tactic of Reagan and Clinton. The reason I didn't mention Clinton, although he's, you know, also a great communicator, is that if you look at the record, there's not, you know, a series of really significant accomplishments to go with that communicating ability. Probably the biggest accomplishment was the deal with the Republicans in 96 to raise the minimum wage, but then to rewrite the entitlement program for families with dependent children.
I actually think the Family and Medical Leave Act is something that Bill Clinton can get some credit for progressive legislation.
You know, and I know your time is short, but there's an issue that
about 7 minutes.
Okay, definitely got to ask you about Marco Rubio. Of course, Watergate is, you know, that was a lot. And I actually think that there is some that's a significant issue. But with Marco Rubio and what I see is kind of this kind of affirmative action thing going on with the Republicans where they're saying, you know, well, Bobby Jindal's the brownest guy we can have. Maybe him, Marco Rubio. Hey, this guy has he has a Latino heritage. What are your thoughts historically on how it works? Well, we don't have a history historical precedents. What are your thoughts on this move of the Republican Party to pretend to be the party of ethnicity?
Great point. By the way, the reason I didn't mention family and medical leave was it was passed when there was still Democratic Congresses in 93. I was looking at, you know, dealing with divided government.
Okay.
Now, with respect to Marco Rubio and the Republicans, Republicans have two enormous problems confronting them. One is the internal contradictions within their own ideology. And we have seen that on the immigration issue perhaps more than any, where the kind of ethnocentric America First Republicans are hitting smash up against the business Republicans. The business Republicans understand the enormous contribution of immigrants, including undocumented immigrants, to the American economy, and are interested. Even George W. Bush was in regularizing this. John McCain is. But as we know, the ethnocentric Republicans believe that this immigration is somehow diluting the true American pioneer stock and value. So they have these internal contradictions. And number two, they are operating on the wrong side of demography. And one thing you can't beat in politics is demography. Their base is white and Protestant, and that is the most rapidly shrinking part of the American electorate.
And the elderly, because they're losing the young, too. And guess what? The elderly,
right.
That generation is shrinking, obviously, and young people are the next generation. So that's why you see them toning down a lot of their anti-gay rhetoric, for example.
Right. So one of the things that they believe in that's going to help them with the rapidly growing Hispanic vote is to put an Hispanic face on the party. And Marco Rubio is certainly an articulate, attractive Hispanic face. The problem is it's the same old wine in a new bottle. Mitt Romney
W-H-I-N-E?
Is that Marco Rubio's speech. It was stock, classic, Republican talking points.
Right.
It could have been delivered without even hearing Barack Obama's State of the Union. In fact, it was discordant. You know, it was a lot of it attacking Barack Obama, yet his speech didn't attack Republicans. His speech simply put forth his ideas.
I think you misspelled wine. I think it's W-H-I-N-E in the old bottles.
I love it.
Because it was a very whiny speech. It really was. He just seemed very he's not being fair.
Well, what I heard it was almost like the old Charlie Brown teacher where all you ever heard was wah, 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 wah. Because
it was not an effective speech. Now, you know, I understand how hard it is to follow the President of the United States, and you're standing there in a sterile environment. The President is speaking, you know, in front of the Congress, the Supreme Court justices, the Joint Chiefs. It's very tough. This wasn't, you know, an absolute disaster from Rubio the way Bobby Jindal's speech was a number of years ago, but it certainly did not help the Republican cause. And Republicans, you know, have to understand the Hispanic voter is not superficial and shallow. Simply, you know, trying to put an Hispanic face forward is not going to do it if you're still going to be obstinate on substance.
Plus, let's face it, a Cuban American is very different from other Latinos.
Mexican
American. I mean, Dominican, Puerto Rican. I mean, every single Latino group except Cubans is strongly liberal, strongly supporter of the Democratic Party, and even Cuban Americans are starting to move. The younger ones tend to be more liberal. So I also think he was not a typical Latino American either.
Before you do, I want to ask you about Texas. You know, there's a lot of talk about the Texas going blue. Will it go blue? When will it go blue? What are your thoughts on Texas being blue?
Yeah, I know a lot about Texas politics, and of course, as we know, you know, first Tom Lay and then more recent Republican politicians have very strongly gerrymandered the state of Texas, which is now majority non-white, to create these Anglo-dominated enclaves of Republican strength and to pack the black and Latino voters and other Democrats into a relatively few districts. This is why they overwhelmingly control the congressional delegation. At some point, Texas will turn blue because over the next 20 years or so, 40% of the population is going to be Hispanic. You add that to the black and Asian population, it's going to be approaching 60%. And these gerrymandering attempts to hang on aren't going to work. But the big but is the Latinos in Texas have to get themselves organized. Obviously, the rate at which Hispanics become citizens is very important. But even among citizens, the turnout and mobilization is still very, very low. And that's why it's hard to predict when Texas is going to turn blue, because it's not strictly a matter of numbers. It's also a matter of mobilization and turnout. And the Hispanic leaders in Texas have a lot of work to do if they want to break the grip of conservative Anglo-Republicans on their state.
I think part of it is a face. People want to vote for someone. And the mayor of San Antonio, I forgot his name, he's got the twin brother.
Right.
But it seems to me that's a very attractive new face out there and a reason for Latinos to organize and vote that they might not do just to stop the Republicans.
Well, I'm a big believer when it comes to politics, particular presidential politics, is charisma.
That's
but
right.
It's very
well,
important.
Well, they had charisma.
There was a keynote, Julian Castro.
Right, Julian Castro. That's what I'm talking about. Yes,
to.
I am.
At the Democratic convention,
right.
And is, you know, a very strong, he and his twin are very strong Hispanic leaders. And you're right, there haven't been that many prominent, charismatic Hispanic leaders. But, you know, you also got to put the onus on the people themselves. You know, and this is what we talked about, you know, before I even got on the show. You know, people have to stand up for their rights, and there are ways to do that. You know, as much as you want to rail against the system, there are ways to do that within the system. And one way to do that is to mobilize and to vote.
And all we need to do is look at the civil rights movement as always. I always refer to the civil rights movement as the model because they faced overwhelming odds for a long, long time. And they were patient and they fought inside and outside the system and they were organized and they did everything right. And there's no way that based on what they were up against, they should have won. But they got
what they wanted.
They
were up against, you know, an all-white jury system.
Right.
An all-white judge system, an all-white police system. They were up against the fact that juries had virtually never, anywhere in the South, convicted a white person of killing a black. I got to run.
Okay, thank you very much.
I just think it literacy tests.
Guys.
And
take care, Mark and Garland.
Yeah.
Take care.
I think we've got a caller on the line.
Indeed.
Anthony, welcome to WPFW.
How's it going, gentlemen?
Great.
Hi there.
Oh, man, so many things to say with so little time.
We love having Dr. Lichtman on there, Anthony. He really, really has a lot of information and history when it comes to politics.
Well, absolutely. And to that point, speaking of Marco Rubio, Marco Rubio is Hispanic. He is not Latino.
Right.
Herman Cain is a Negro. He is not African-American. You know, when we can go throughout the Republican Party and think about the so-called persons of color that they put forward, and they are persons of color in name only. You know, these are like these are technicalities of ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And it's just so sad, but given that I do prefer a different political persuasion, I'm happy that they're still not getting it right. At the end of the day, when it comes down to issues, when it comes down to substance, they still have very little to offer the overwhelming majority or the increasing majority of the American people. Secondarily, our current Republican Senate primarily does not or was not raised on schoolhouse rocks. They're not interested in governing. So every time we bring up these comparisons wherein, you know, they talk about how Obama has divided government and then they talk about how Lincoln had divided government and, you know, and say, well, this person was able to deal with it. We divided government. We're dealing with a different sort of divided government. The division was ideological, but they were still interested in getting the work of the people done. Obama does not have that luxury, unfortunately. So what he's doing now is what he should have done last term, and what he, and as far as I'm concerned, needs to do a hell of a lot more, which is have the Obama road show. He should put himself on the road like he put Hillary Clinton on the road and not see the White House anytime soon, pushing agenda item after agenda item after agenda item, because there's really no purpose of him being up on the House. I'm sorry, being at the White House trying to build relationships with people who don't want to have relationships with him and who are not interested in governing. Every single solitary thing the Republicans are doing are moving us towards destroying the overall system and then building it back up with these crumbs of scarcity. And those crumbs of scarcity are really the ultimate objective, creating a government that they can drown in a bathtub. And, you know, if they do that, if they ever manage to do that, the people are going to drown along with them. So,
I'll tell you, I agree the roadshow is necessary. I would argue, actually, it began under Bill Clinton when you had the Republicans shut the government down, nuke the Gingrich Revolution, when really the Republicans went from a party that wanted to govern and get their things done to a party that wanted to stop government
right.
and prevent governing and prevent the government from working. And at that time, Bill Clinton went on his own roadshow, and he persuaded Americans that he was right and Gingrich was wrong, and they had to back off. Now, of course, in the Obama era, it's the same thing, you know, multiplied by two or three. But I think it's the same idea, and I think Obama tried to work with them in his first term and learned that he just couldn't. And now he's finally getting the roadshow down right, and he's absolutely doing the right thing with that. Look at the fact that he refused
to. Is this a new person? Okay.
He just looked at the fact that he refused to negotiate on the debt ceiling. He just said, I'm not negotiating. And eventually they had to back down.
We've got another call. We've got another Anthony. Anthony number two, welcome to WPFW. Do we have another Anthony? I guess he's not here. If you were there, second Anthony, feel free to call back. Okay, Mark. So we're looking at, and we've got time for another call or two. So if you're out there, 202-588-0893. Okay, we've got Victor, 202-588-0893. We've got time for another couple of calls. Victor, welcome to WPFW, and thank you very much for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, well,
hi, Victor.
I'm concerned about the tone that seems to be coming through from you and some of the panelists consistently about the value of working within the system and the what you can do by working within the system. I understand the nonviolent philosophy of the station, of course, but when you stress this and say the civil rights movement had many, look at the civil rights movement as an example. I mean, that won political victories and legal victories, but the economic victories are not that visible, and there's 200 of us in jail right now. So you have to question, is that a good tactic, or were those tactics really valid? You look at Egypt, there was a revolution, but was there really a change in power? Last weekend, when you were talking about guns in the last week's show, you talked about policemen and judges being basically beyond reproach. They're just civil servants. Well, are they really? What tactics are right and what tactics are wrong? It seems that the philosophy of you and perhaps the station seems you're getting very conservative.
Well, thank you for certainly thank you for your opinion. Don't leave. We still want to certainly discuss this. Did we lose him? Oh, I think we might have lost Victor. But at any rate, 202-588-0893, we have time for another call. Well, my point goes to this. When you have an issue, you always look at your alternatives. And my point is this. Violence is not an alternative. There's not an instance where I see when the U.S., the country, our national policy, when we've used violence, it's never worked well. Yeah, so I don't believe.
Neither Garland nor I are saying that the police or judges are beyond reproach. We attack the police and the judges every time, we have for years here. I think what we're saying is that there are certain channels to go through,
mm-hmm.
and you should try those. Garland was just giving an example that succeeded, where he sued his police department for racism and succeeded. If those channels fail, there are other channels. Everything from protests in the streets, that's civil mm-hmm. rights movement, to coming on stations and then talking about things, the press. There's inside and outside strategy. So I don't think we're saying that the inside strategy always works by any stretch, but we're saying it's something that should be tried along with an outside strategy.
And see, when you think about what Martin Luther King stood for, what he stood for was consistency. So if I say the government's wrong because they use violence, well, how are you going to react? With violence. What am I saying? That I'm not against violence. I'm simply against someone else using violence for what they want to accomplish. Now, if I want to accomplish something, well, then it's okay for me to use violence. Well, the fact of the matter is there's a contradiction there, and you're creating a paradox. Because if you say it's okay to use violence, how could you ever have said that it was wrong for someone else to use violence?
You know, I was just at the Martin Luther King Memorial today.
Yeah.
I was wandering around looking at it, and I remembered the quote that's listed up there, where he said that the only way to fight darkness is not not with darkness, but with light. The only way to fight hate is not with hate,
and if
but
you look
with
at,
love.
We're going to get to a call, but and if you look at the history of violent overthrows, what happens when there's violent revolutions? The revolutionaries take over and start running the government, and they're worse than the people who were running the government before.
And that's what we fear in Egypt.
And that's the history of violent revolutionaries. Why? Because they were just as violent. They used the exact same tactics that they claimed were wrong, which means they had to have the same mental and emotional perspective as the people they were against, or they wouldn't have used the same tactics. RG, glad to hear from you. Welcome to WPFW.
How's it going, fellas?
Great. Hey, RG.
Talk to you in a while. Congratulations on your new show, Garland, and Mark.
Thank you.
Where's Terry these days?
What's that?
He said, where's Terry? Terry's in Oregon.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, may get to the point. As an aside, people speaking about Black History Month, I haven't heard a single account that was correct on the history of Black History Month. It was actually started as Negro History Week, and I had to double-check that because I remembered it being extended to a month, but people said that it was preceded by being called Negro History Month, but it was actually only a week for the longest time. Anyway, to the basic point, Garland, you as a law enforcement officer, I know you probably
retired.
Have some objective as well as subjective viewpoint on Mr. Dorner's misdeeds and escapades. And, you know, I just wondered if you had any input as to how that affects the inner sanctum of the Wall of Silence, you know, the Blue Guild, if you will. And on President Obama's State of the Union, remember, I think that the one thing that tempered his entire delivery was the fact that he referred to the complicity of Congress as being elemental in getting any of this stuff done. Mm-hmm. And can you guys filter in on that one?
Certainly. You know, the long and short of it is this. Institutions traditionally resist change. Institutions are very, very slow to change. And the law enforcement is an institution that is quasi-military, and we know how slow the military is to change. So law enforcement is right up there. You know, they change at the rate of a glacier. A glacier-like speed. So the issues that are there in law enforcement regarding, you know, they're running 50 years behind the rest of the country. So the issues that are in within law enforcement are not going to go away.
How do you think the Chris Dorner incident will affect law either in the LAPD or other law enforcement across the country? Do you think it'll make them reflect? Or do you think they're just going to go on?
No. Here's the way law enforcement is going to look at it. They're going to look at it like from the perspective of the violence. They're going to look at it from the perspective of if an officer is charged, if an officer is involved with something, if an officer is facing charges, facing accusations, facing something, some issue that they're unhappy with, how do we ensure that they don't act with violence? Can we take their guns?
Can we take their guns away?
You know, what can we do? Which, you know, we could go on with about the issue of guns from this also.
Sure.
Very
powerful weapon.
But as I said, this is a powerful subject in the Black community because law enforcement traditionally has been very oppressive. And here's the deal.
So how do you persuade an LAPD?
I want to throw something else out there. And this is an issue that one of the things that is different in the Black community than, say, in the white community when it comes to law enforcement. Everybody, most Americans know that there are two criminal justice systems in the United States, one for the poor and one for the rich.
Sure.
And banking, whatever it is, there's different rules in this country for the poor than there are for the rich. The reality is, if you're a white poor person, you're not going, if you look at, if you're not going to get the same treatment in the criminal justice system as a rich white person. However, when it comes to the Black community, whether you're in the lowest socioeconomic level and you're the poorest of poor, or whether you're Skip Gates and you're the president's best friend, if you're Black, law enforcement sees you in the same light and they treat you the same. That's one of the reasons why Skip Gates was so upset. If he was a white guy and he was a Harvard professor and he was the president's friend, he would get different treatment.
Well, he didn't get the treatment because the cop didn't know he was a Harvard professor.
The bottom line.
Henry Louis Gates.
The only thing he knew when he saw Skip Gates was that he was a black guy. And so he gets treated. So from the in the black community, it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic status. It doesn't matter what it you get treated the same way, which is the worst of the worst. And I think that's what the black community really faces. One of the things that the black community has traditionally faced is very different from the
So how does that change? What's the step to change that? I mean,
if I had that answer, I'd bottle it and can it and spray it on everybody.
The mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa, is by all accounts a good, decent human being. He's Latino. He appoints the commission that chooses the chief of police. Well, so at the end of the day, I think it's up to our political leaders to make these kinds of changes.
Well, we certainly want to thank Bill Weatherspoon. I'm thinking of a basketball guy in the NBA. Bill Weatherspoon, who is out there running the board, who's making this thing happen and answering the phones and using his technical expertise to do things that I wouldn't ever understand with all those blinking lights and slides. I certainly want to thank Mark for his brilliance. We want to thank Dr. Lichtman. Also, coming up next, Robin Holden and Carolyn Tyson. Robin's Place. They've got great music tonight. They're featuring. They're doing the Robin's Place will be there. Then, now, and tomorrow. Then, Sarah Vaughan. Now, Dee Dee Bridgewater. And tomorrow, Sandra Y. Johnson. Good music coming up next on Robin's Place. You got to be listening to that because I surely will. Thank you.